Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Monday, April 15th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, some Mississippi lawmakers want to replace the federal health insurance exchange with a state-based one. From the Gulf States newsroom, crawfish prices skyrocketed this season. Farmers and fishermen are struggling as they try to sell the little crawfish they've been able to catch. Plus, the deadline to file 2023 tax returns is tonight, midnight. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Mississippi lawmakers are considering if a state-based insurance exchange could be a cheaper option for residents than using the federal one. The current system was established under the Affordable Care Act. At least 22 other states have already created a version of state-run exchanges. 286,000 Mississippians rely on the federal marketplace for their health care coverage. Officials estimate it would save the state more than $28 million per year. State Insurance Commissioner Mike Cheney speaks with our Will Stribling about how a state exchange would operate. Cheney says it would be a major change, but could reduce the premiums enrollees have to pay.
In most likelihood, they would go down a little bit, not a great deal, but they would go down 4 or 5% in premium cost. So it might help somebody's pocketbook. The second thing that would happen would be that we would be enabled to do more cost share reductions for the consumer, and that simply means that we can lower the out-of-pocket cost and yearly out-of-pocket cost to a lower number, which benefits them. And the other thing is, if you operate a state-based exchange, the dollars that go back to the federal government are about 2.5% below what they're taking now. And that 2.5% in numbers is about $30 million you would save that would not go back to the federal government for running the exchange. And the state would keep that $30 million, and they could do a lot with it. They could spend it to help those people that are uninsured. They could lower premiums for the rest of the community. There's just a lot of things they could do to help the consumer.
You've said before that if we were to set up a state-based exchange, we could add more providers to the pool. How would that impact pricing and options for consumers?
So if the state of Mississippi were to operate a state-based health insurance exchange instead of the federal government, and there are three types of exchanges, those that are operated by the federal government, a state-based exchange that's operated using the federal format, and a pure state-based exchange. Under the format and this pure state-based exchange, the state would have the option to add other companies on to sell other products that may not get tax credits, but could be marketed to the consumer, and that it would include things like dental plans. Some of that's done today, but we would add anywhere from 2 to 5 more companies that would have options on the exchange. You would have more individual choices than you've had before, and there's always the ability on the state-based exchange to go back and add what we call them shop policies, and that's small business health option plans where small employers and individual entrepreneurships with less than 50 employees may be able to have their employees buy off the exchange and not violate federal law. So it's a win-win for a lot of folks if you have a state-based exchange.
In your opinion, would it be worth the state to take the time and money that it would cost to set this up? Do the benefits outweigh the cost, both in terms of dollars and manpower there?
Setting up a state-based exchange does benefit the state, and it's worth the time and effort that would go into it. This is not something new that I, as commissioner, have come across. We actually looked at a state-based exchange back in 2011 and 12, and we denied the ability to operate the exchange by the federal government. There are 19 states that have state-based exchanges, and three states, and those are Oregon, Arkansas, and Georgia, have a federally based state-based exchange, and that's what we would have if we set one up for the first 2 years. In other words, the federal government kind of holds your hands for a year or 2 years to make certain you can operate a state-based exchange. You have to have approval from the federal government to do this, and I would not anticipate any problem, but there are a lot of benefits that the state would incur. And the question of how would you finance a setup, Georgia, as an example, had an appropriation from the legislature to finance the setting up of an exchange, which they will pay that back with monies that are earned by the exchange. In the case of Mississippi, we have an income stream that's not in the general fund that could be used to operate the exchange to set it up, and it would pay it back. And that money's in the high-risk pool. There are a lot of folks that think that we're going to assess people to operate the exchange. That's not so. You would assess the people that are on the exchange, the five companies that are there now, but they're already being assessed by the federal government. Our assessment would just be less than what the feds have. So there's no new assessments on anybody other than what exists right now. There's no money coming out of the general fund if we were to set a state-based exchange up. And even if we didn't do it in the year of 2024 to begin the 1st of January of 2025, that availability to do a state-based exchange would be there as another tool in our toolbox to provide consumers with health insurance that will reduce costs. And a pretty good product at that, I must say.
Could you tell me a bit about the impact that setting up a state-based exchange has had in those three states that you mentioned that have models similar to what we'd implement? Arkansas and Georgia were two of them.
Arkansas and Georgia and Oregon have these federally based state-based exchanges. Their experience has been very good. Of the 19 other states that have state-based exchanges, like Virginia and Kentucky would be a good example, they have been very pleased with their outcome of state-based exchanges. The reason that they've had good outcomes is they got in early. They've been able to operate the exchanges very successfully, and they have a better choice for the consumer than the states that have a federally based mandate. Now, Arkansas's plan is kind of brand new because they're using some Medicaid dollars to pay for their state-based exchange. I don't know if that would happen in Mississippi. That would be a legislative issue for them to address. But from a commissioner's point of view, we have the funds available to do a state-based exchange without going to the general fund, and there's no assessments needed. So that's left up to the legislature. We've told them in a hearing this past week exactly where we were. We gave them the cost numbers and all the other dollars that would be associated. So they're fully up to speed as to what it will take to do a state-based exchange.
In the slides that you provided during that meeting, I saw that the vast majority of Mississippians that are on the exchange are receiving cost-sharing reductions. Can you explain how that works?
So what would happen would be with a cost-sharing reduction, the federal government has programs that go straight back to reduce the premium or what comes out of pocket. And what happens is that if a consumer goes to the doctor and they have one of these policies and they are billed, it would come to the insurance company. And what the insurance company, let's say it's Company X, it's on the exchange, would do would apply the federal cost-sharing plan to that out-of-pocket reduction that normally the consumer would be billed for, and they pay it direct to the healthcare provider. So the bottom line is it's a win-win for the consumer. The dollars go back to the health insurance company, who in turn pays the healthcare provider. The premium stays level, and that's important to understand that those premiums stay level and cost-sharing reductions are part of the premium. And that sounds kind of complicated, but the reason for it is you get into tax bases and how much tax a company would owe the state, the federal government. So the reductions go straight back to the companies to pay the health care provider, so it's not taxable.
Mike Chaney is Mississippi's insurance commissioner. Next, from the Gulf States newsroom, it's been a strain on the crawfish industry, with the supply of crawfish at an all-time low. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hi, Larry Morrissey with the Mississippi Arts Commission. Please join me and my colleagues for the Mississippi Arts Hour, where we have in-depth conversations with different creative Mississippians. That's the Mississippi Arts Hour, Sundays at 5 on Think Radio, or download it as a podcast.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. This crawfish season has been a rough one. Farmers and fishermen are catching a tiny percentage of what they normally would, and consumers are paying higher prices. WWNO's Eva Tusfai and Gulf States Newsroom's Maya Miller talked to crawfish farmers and fishermen about how they're navigating one of the worst seasons they've ever seen.
So, Maya, someone told me that there's an app that you can use to look at crawfish prices.
Oh, cool. What's it called?
The Crawfish App.
Oh, that's obvious. Let me look it up.
Yeah. Let me know what you see. When I looked at it, it said, like, something crazy, like $9. But that was a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Right now, I'm seeing crawfish at $7.99, $8.49, even some as high as $9.99 a pound, which is kind of wild because I'm used to buying crawfish for, like, $3 a pound.
Yeah, so those prices are high because of last year's drought. It caused many problems for the people who catch those crawfish for a living. People like Adler Stelly. I went out to his farm in Abbeville, Louisiana, just outside of Lafayette. And Maya, have you ever seen a crawfish farm?
No, I'm not a big fan of the outdoors.
Well, most of them are also rice farms. So picture a wide open flooded field. We head out on a small motorboat to catch the crawfish. He takes out the traps, dumps some crawfish in the boat, tosses a pogie in for bait, and throws it back in the water. He gets a good amount of decent-sized crawfish. It's a bit more than what he's been catching so far, but it won't be enough to save him this season.
There's no way of making back the money that of the input that we have out there, but there are crawfish starting to come in areas. We do need the consumers to get out there and start eating a few.
Stelly has been crawfish farming his entire life, and he says this is the worst season he's ever seen. His only silver lining is this happened before he passes the farm down to his daughter.
As hard as it is to take in this type of hit, I'm glad that it's happening to me after I've been in business for a few years, and not happening to her on her first year trying to really get in business on her own.
He says inflation was already hitting the farm, with the price of labor and bait increasing. Last year's drought made input costs even higher because he had to flood his fields much more than he normally would.
The drought and the extreme heat is also what killed the crawfish. It made the ground so dry that they couldn't breathe, says Mark Shirley, an extension agent with the LSU Ag Center.
There was no moisture to keep the gills working, and they just died. So probably 90% or more of the crawfish died in their burrows during the summertime.
Farmers will also have to pay to replace the crawfish needed for breeding for next year.
Yeah, and that costs a lot of money. Mike Strain is the commissioner at Louisiana's Department of Agriculture and Forestries. He says this drought is costing the industry something like $140 million this year.
Some of the farmers quit fishing completely because there are no crawfish.
Strain, as well as some Louisiana lawmakers, reached out to the U.S. Department of Agriculture for help. They want to activate the Emergency Livestock Assistance Program, which would send payments to farmers. Strain says it would provide much-needed relief to farmers who are in debt.
I'm hearing from the farmers that many of them cannot get another crop loan because they were not able to pay off last year's crop loan, and they desperately need those dollars.
Louisiana's Governor Jeff Landry even announced a disaster declaration to speed up the process.
But there are some people who are going to be left out.
Yeah, it's the wild crawfish fishermen, the people who aren't farming them, like Jody Mesh.
We don't ever get any help from the government.
Mesh is a third-generation Cajun living near the Atchafalaya Basin in South Louisiana. He's been trapping wild crawfish for 30 years and is not eligible for that federal relief.
He says, basin water levels have been declining for the past few decades. That means less habitat for the crawfish, and he's had to figure out each slow season on his own.
When COVID hit, you know, we suffered the loss in the market shutting down the same way the crawfish farmers did. And our congressional delegation got millions of dollars of help for the farmers, and the basin fishermen got no help at all.
During a good season, Mesh would collect about 1,000 pounds of crawfish every day. Now he's barely breaking 100. He can sell it at around $8 a pound, which means he could make about $800 for a day's work. But with fuel for his boat and bait for his traps, he's thousands in the hole.
But he says crawfish fishing is what he was raised to do. He wants to continue the legacy of his father and grandfather.
It's just that drive to not be a failure and to be able to continue to do it like they were able to do it.
Until the crawfish recover, he says he'll continue to head out onto the water well before dawn to see what his traps have for him.
For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Eva Tesvai.
And I'm Maya Miller.
The Gulf States Newsroom is a partnership between Mississippi Public Broadcasting and public radio stations in Alabama and Louisiana. Coming up, today's the deadline to file 2023 tax returns. We speak with the IRS about what last-minute filers need to know. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Family Fun Day will be in the Pohl Gymnasium on the campus of Mississippi University for Women in Columbus on Saturday, April 20th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. MPB has partnered with the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, MUW, and the Preservation Society of Columbus to host the free event. Come and meet MPB's own Ed Said. The whole family can enjoy music, a health fair, games and activities related to science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Register at education.mpbonline.org.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Today is the last day to file taxes for 2023, and the deadline to send them in is midnight. Some folks may qualify for an extension, but experts say that doesn't weigh the requirement to pay if taxes are owed. Our Kobe Vance speaks with Cesar Yabor, a spokesperson for the IRS, about what folks need to know before filing their paperwork.
Today, being filing day, the biggest issue that we have, of course, is taxpayers need to file on time by midnight today. The largest charge that the IRS imposes on taxpayers is actually not about paying late, but about filing late. So it's imperative that taxpayers either file their 1040 by midnight today, or that they file for an extension, and that is Form 4868. That's 4868, and it's available on our website at irs.gov. It's a very easy one-page form to fill out, and once you have that established, you have until October 15th to file all your documents. But this is key. Getting the extension in place for yourself does not absolve you of paying at least an estimated tax amount by midnight today. You still have to pay on time today. But the October 15th date allows you to file your paperwork anytime between now and October 15th.
If someone was to postmark their tax filings, would today still be a good day to do that, or would they need to find a more direct path?
Oh, no, they can do it today, by midnight today. Remember the classic situation of people lining up at the post office. I don't think they do that anymore, but yes, as long as you postmark your paper filing by midnight of April 15th, you're good.
Now, you mentioned something earlier, and that's people getting an extension. Before we touch on all of that, I did want to address some possible confusion people may have. There's been news going around that some states are getting an extra couple days on the deadline, but I don't think Mississippi is one of those states, correct?
That is correct. Maine and Massachusetts are the two states that have gotten a slight extension because of the local holidays in those two states. But the rest of the United States, including Mississippi, it's a traditional tax date, April 15th.
So going back to the extensions you mentioned, October, that's around 6 months, correct?
That is correct.
Why do y'all choose that time, and what are some of the common reasons people need that extension?
Well, typically, folks who are taking an income from other sources, not necessarily the traditional employer who's providing a W-2, They may get other kinds of forms, variations on Form 1099. There's several versions of that form that cover different kinds of income, and sometimes those forms come in late. Also, there are situations where an employer has not sent the W-2 to a taxpayer, or the W-2 that was sent has incorrect information, and all of that takes time to sort out. Of course, the biggest reason folks may not want to file on time is because of the misconception that if they file for the extension, they can pay late. But as I've mentioned before, that is not correct. The late filing date of October 15th only allows for the filing, not for paying late.
What other advice do you have for people that are trying to do their last-minute taxes today?
Most of these are common sense things. Number one, double and triple check how you're inputting information, whether you're doing it electronically or you're doing it on the paper forms. Make sure that your Social Security number is correct. If you have dependents, that their Social Security numbers are correct. Double and triple check the numbers that you're inputting. If there's a mistake, you could cause delays in your processing of your return. You may even have a reduced refund if you were expecting a refund, or you know, you could end up with a debt that you weren't expecting, and all of that based on a mistake. So please, please, please double and triple check your work. If you're paper filing, folks may remember how they used to have to look up the tax tables. That still exists. If you're paper filing, make sure that when you're looking up where you fall on the tax tables that accompany the Form 1099, make sure that you're double and triple checking and you've got that correct. Here's a good one. Sign your form. You have no idea how many forms arrive at the Internal Revenue Service that weren't signed. Everything else is great, but no signature, and that's not good. And if you have a tax preparer doing the form, make sure that they're inputting their electronic filing ID number. All legitimate tax preparers have an ID number that they have to input on the tax forms. Make sure you have the correct address of the IRS office that you're supposed to be sending your return to. That's available on irs.gov. You can look up, depending on where you are in the country. Not everyone is filing from Mississippi, even though they may be residents of Mississippi. So make sure that you've got the right address. The quickest way to pay is to pay electronically. That's the safest and the most convenient way. And you can use your debit card or your credit card to make a payment if you choose to do that. So, you know, that's always better than sending a check, which could get lost in the mail. If you are filing an extension, make sure that you're doing that by April 15th. And like I said, the form is a short form, especially compared to the 1040 form, and very easy to find on irs.gov. Now, if you need help, if all of this is still befuddling a taxpayer, and they really feel that they need in-person help, visit one of our tax assistance centers in Mississippi. There's one in Jackson. They're free scattered in other parts of the state. So look up the local tax assistance center of the IRS on irs.gov, and our folks will be happy to help.
Better get there early. It might be busy.
Yes.
And then lastly, I just want to touch on the idea of scams right now. I imagine some people are going to be taking opportunity of the confusion of tax season to, you know, make phone calls that are fraudulent, telling people they have to pay up. What are some things that y'all tell taxpayers to look out for and ways that, you know, y'all do or don't contact taxpayers?
The most important thing here is that the IRS will never, never, never reach out to a taxpayer by any other means other than a letter. That initial contact is by mail, by a traditional postal mail. You will never receive a phone call from someone claiming to be from the Internal Revenue Service, or let alone phone texts or direct messages on social media platforms. Never, never, never. Now, once a person receives a letter, an official letter from the Internal Revenue Service, there'll be a phone number inside that in that letter, and perhaps the name of an agent. Then you can establish a relationship at that point telephonically, via email, you know, as long as you're securely emailing your information back and forth. But all of that comes after the initial contact from the Internal Revenue Service, which is only by mail with a hard copy paper letter.
That was Cesar Yelbor. He is a spokesperson for the IRS. This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.